I pretended to be a therapist to get close to her. Ava Monroe, the girl with secrets I needed to unravel. Not to heal her, but to destroy her. What started as revenge became obsession. Her trauma mirrored mine, her words cut deeper than therapy ever could. And somewhere along the way, I stopped playing doctor and started losing myself. But the worst part? She knew the whole time. She wasn't my patient, she was my punishment. And by the time I realized I was the one being analyzed, the camera was already recording. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Shrink Wrapped. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. The Credentials I Never Earned. There's a particular silence in therapy offices, an engineered stillness. It's not the kind you find in libraries or cathedrals. It's softer, more sinister, a silence built for unraveling. One that settles into your throat like static, encourages disclosure. Or confession. I learned that before I ever faked a single credential. The walls of this office, my office for all intents and purposes, are a pale gray, hand-brushed to appear more textured than they are. Professional, yet not sterile. The couch is cream linen, sleek, minimal, almost delicate. I didn't choose it. Neither did I choose the polished bamboo floors or the obsidian paperweight shaped like a brain on the desk. Everything here was already perfectly curated. I just stepped into it like an actress walking into a pre-lit set. Dr. A. Lawrence. The name glows faintly on the brass plate mounted on the door. It matches the one embroidered on the lab coat in the closet and the one printed on the diplomas arranged behind my chair. Harvard, Stanford, and a few embellished fellowships for flair. To the average eye, it's all seamless. To the careful eye, well, the careful eye is what I came for. I memorized everything about Dr. Lawrence's life before I stole it. Her mannerisms, her clinical interests, her research articles, which I annotated and practiced discussing in mirror monologues. Her voice was smooth, professional, and borderline detached. I perfected it. There were hours, weeks of video footage to study. You'd be surprised how many public webinars doctors record these days. But this isn't just some long con. It isn't about money or curiosity. I took this identity for one reason. For one patient. One name I knew would come looking for help eventually. Ava Monroe. The first time I saw her name on the client intake portal, I forgot how to breathe. Literally. My lungs just paused. She'd used her real name. Her actual date of birth. I expected a pseudonym, maybe something cryptic, some alias to protect herself. But no. She walked straight into the lion's mouth wearing no disguise at all. Thursday at 3 p.m. I gave her the best hour I had. I always knew it would be her slot. Ever since I accepted my first client under this facade, I left that hour untouched, reserved. Manifesting. Waiting. When she walked in, it was like watching a ghost enter my body. She looked exactly the same and completely different. You know the way trauma carves itself into people? Not like scars, more like echoes. She had those echoes. In her posture. In the way she barely made eye contact. In the trembling hesitation just before she sat down, as if asking permission from the air itself. She was dressed in oversized clothes. Gray hoodie. Black leggings. No jewelry. Her hair was twisted up like she hadn't even glanced at herself that day. She clutched a reusable water bottle with both hands, even though it was empty. A prop for safety. A weapon if needed. "You look younger than I expected," she said. It was the first thing out of her mouth. I smiled, controlled. The smile of someone used to disarming skeptics. "Younger's not always a bad thing," I replied, voice carefully pitched. "It can mean I'm flexible. Adaptive." She nodded slowly, but there was a glint in her eye I didn't like. Not suspicion. Amusement. The way someone looks when they're watching a magician perform a trick they already know. She settled into the couch without relaxing. Every limb was coiled, ready to spring. But she wasn't anxious. That's what unnerved me. She was rehearsed. Like me. "So," I said, folding my hands over my notepad. "What made you reach out?" Her lips parted, then closed. She looked away, toward the window where soft sunlight draped itself over the bookshelf like it belonged there. "Finally," she said. "I don't know. I guess I just wanted someone to witness it. The mess, I mean." "Witnessing is part of the work," I said. "Not fixing," she asked, her tone light but loaded. I offered her a small shrug. "Some things don't need fixing. Just understanding." That made her laugh, a short, bitter sound. "You're one of those therapists. I tilted my head, pretending to take it in stride. Inside, my stomach had already begun its slow twist. There was something about the way she said therapist. Like she knew it wasn't a title I earned. She let the silence stretch. I have nightmares, she said finally. But they're not mine. That got my attention. They belong to someone else. I asked. She blinked slowly. No, they're mine. But they feel borrowed. Like someone else gave them to me. I nodded slowly, carefully. That can happen when trauma is absorbed from others. Vicarious trauma. Sometimes if we've spent too long around damaged people. I wasn't around them. I was with them, she cut in. Her voice wasn't loud, but it was sharp. I made a note, though the page remained blank. It's the motion that matters. Ava began talking more freely after that. Bits and pieces. Nothing too concrete. Mentions of a childhood that was fragmented. Of partners who didn't know how to love gently, of a fear of mirrors at night. Not the kind of fear rooted in folklore, no Bloody Mary superstition. A fear of recognition, of seeing something she didn't want to acknowledge staring back. It was textbook, and it wasn't, because every word she said seemed carefully chosen, like she knew the diagnostic language already and was feeding me just enough to see what I'd do with it. I matched her tone for tone, reflective but not invasive, insightful but vague, the way real therapists do when they're waiting for a deeper reveal. But all the while, my own brain was spiraling beneath the surface, because her trauma sounded familiar, not just thematically, specifically, names she didn't say but alluded to, events she framed in metaphors. It was like she was recounting my own buried history in code, and it rattled me. You ever feel like you're lying? She asked near the end of the session. Even when you're telling the truth? The way she said it, it wasn't casual. It wasn't exploratory. It was surgical. I froze. Just for a second. But long enough. She smiled. Not warmly. Not nervously. With satisfaction. Then she stood up. Session over. I sat in the office long after she left, the room suddenly colder, as if she'd taken the heat with her. Later that night, I poured myself a whiskey and opened the encrypted recording on my laptop, watching the session back frame by frame, analyzing everything. Her body language didn't scream deception, but it didn't scream vulnerability either. It screamed intention, like she came here knowing exactly what she was doing. And the worst part? I found myself captivated, not by her story, but by her delivery, her rhythm, the way her voice dipped when talking about abandonment, then surged with subtle defiance when discussing control. It was performance, but so was mine. We were both lying, both watching each other. And I realized then, I might not be the only one with a plan. Chapter 2, The Art of Mirroring Lies. There are two kinds of silence, the kind that suffocates, and the kind that listens. Therapy rooms are built for the second, designed to cradle a pause long enough for it to give birth to something profound, or damning. That's what I usually count on, that if I stay quiet long enough, people will fill the void with something real. A tremor. A truth. But Ava doesn't do that. She's comfortable in the quiet. Weaponizes it. Uses it to make you squirm. Not because she's malicious, but because she knows the value of stillness. She knows that silence makes people show their cards. And I have far too many to keep hidden. It was our second session. Thursday again. 3 p.m. again. The golden hour. Only this time I wasn't prepared. I barely slept the night before. I spent hours rewatching our first session, dissecting every syllable, every blink, every micro twitch of her mouth, trying to determine whether she knew, not suspected, knew. I kept thinking about the way she asked that question. Do you ever feel like you're lying even when you're telling the truth? That wasn't a question. It was a provocation. I arrived early to the office that day, 2 hours early, because I couldn't sit still at home. I paced the space like a restless ghost, repositioning the books on the shelves, adjusting the lighting, rehearsing my answers to questions she hadn't asked yet. I reminded myself, you are Dr. A. Lawrence. You trained at Harvard. You did your postdoc at Yale. You have a reputation, a waitlist, and a trusted voice. And then I reminded myself again, no, you don't. You're nobody wearing someone else's skin. The anxiety was a physical thing. A damp film behind my knees. A fluttering under my ribs. I chewed the inside of my cheek until I tasted blood, then blotted my mouth discreetly with a tissue before she arrived. When Ava stepped into the office, she didn't say hello. She looked at the couch, at the window, then at me. Her gaze hovered for a second too long on my wrist, the watch, specifically. A vintage Cartier I found in Dr. Lawrence's desk drawer and wore like armor. New, she asked, nodding toward it. I smiled too quickly. Gift. graduation. Impressive. She sat. Same spot. Same posture. Legs tucked under, arms crossed. But something was different. Less guarded. Or maybe just better at pretending. Rough week, I asked, keeping my tone light. She tilted her head. Why do you think that? I paused. You're tense. Maybe I'm always tense. Maybe, I agreed. But today you're tense with purpose. She laughed softly. You make everything sound poetic. Is that a technique? Yes, I admitted. It's called reflective empathy. Sounds manipulative. It can be, I said, matching her honesty. But it's also effective. She didn't respond. Just looked at me again, long and slow, like she was peeling me apart layer by layer. It felt surgical. Like she wasn't trying to see me, she was trying to confirm me. You ever Google your therapist? She asked suddenly. My throat tightened, but I kept my expression smooth. Have you? Would it bother you? Not if you told me about it. She smiled. What if I did it before our first session? I forced a chuckle. Curiosity is normal. We live in a digital age. No one's truly anonymous. She leaned back. You're hard to find. No social media. No photos on your clinic's website. Just a name on a door. My pulse thrummed beneath the Cartier band. I folded my hands, subtly pressing my thumbnail into the base of my palm. Pain helps focus. That's intentional, I said. Some clinicians prefer privacy. It creates space for clients to project what they need. Sounds like a great way to hide. Silence. Not the soft kind. Not the listening kind. The suffocating kind. I exhaled through my nose. Hiding and protecting are different things. Depends who you're protecting, she replied. Yourself or someone else. She said it too calmly. No accusation. No edge. Just a clinical observation. My trick. Being used against me. I pivoted. How's sleep been? A pause. Then a smirk. Deflection. Another technique. No, I said gently. A reminder that you came here for help. Did I? And there it was. A crack in the facade. Or maybe just a reflection of mine. We sat like that for a while. The clock ticking behind me like a metronome. Each second stretching wider than the last. I wondered if she could hear the pulse in my throat. If she could sense the way my entire nervous system was beginning to short-circuit. Then she spoke. Soft. Controlled. Devastating. My mother once told me that the people who try the hardest to help you are usually the ones who've hurt someone else. I blinked. What did you make of that? I didn't, she said. Not until I met you. That night I didn't drink. I didn't pace. I didn't sleep. I sat in my living room, lights off, watching the video on loop. That last line, not until I met you, repeated in my head like a curse. Was she bluffing? Testing me? Or was it confirmation that she knew who I was? Not just the fake license, the stolen office, the lies, but me. The version of me I buried in another city. Another name. Another life. There had been a moment during our session, a flash of something, when she mentioned protecting others. And I swear I saw something flicker across her face. Recognition. Not the kind you fake. A kind only someone with a shared wound can summon. That's when it hit me. Maybe I wasn't the only one in the room pretending to be someone else. The next morning, I pulled up her intake file again. Basic demographics. Age 27. Writer. Lives alone. Listed no emergency contacts. Trauma history. Fragmented memories. Possible CPTSD. Presenting concerns. Sleep disturbance, depersonalization, inherited shame. That phrase jumped out. It wasn't clinical. It was chosen. Deliberately. Like bait. I opened a private document I'd been keeping on her. One not attached to the client records. Notes she'd never see. Impressions. Gut instincts. I updated it. Ava Monroe. Possibly aware of my real identity. Highly observant. Subtle provocateur. Maybe mirroring. Possibly manipulative, possibly traumatized, possibly both. Danger level, increasing. Personal reaction, compromised. I stared at the last word. Compromised. When did this stop being a game I was winning? When did she stop being a mark and start becoming a mirror? I shut the laptop and stared at my reflection in the dark screen. My face looked hollow. Distant. But my eyes, they were alive in a way I hadn't seen in years. Because I wasn't just afraid. I was intrigued. Chapter 3. The shadow in her voice. Trust is a theater. A performance both parties agree to believe in. Even when the stage is cracked and the lights are too dim to see what's real. By the third session, Ava had already rewritten the rules of our interaction. She no longer sat with caution. She didn't wait for prompts. She didn't feign uncertainty. Instead, she walked in like she'd been coming here for years. Like this space belonged to her. Like I was the one being invited in. She wore a black turtleneck, hair up in a loose knot. Minimal makeup, but her eyes looked darker than usual. And I couldn't tell if it was sleep deprivation or strategy. She held a small Moleskine notebook and a black pen, which she toyed with as she sat. No water bottle today. That struck me. She'd put down the prop. You look tired, she said as soon as I closed the door. I smiled automatically. Long week. Funny. I'd say the same thing, but I haven't done anything. Nothing at all. Not unless you count thinking. Thinking is doing, I said, easing into the chair. Especially when it's about pain. Do you think I'm in pain? Are you? She opened the notebook. I wrote something down for you. I stilled. Poetry? I asked. No, she said, flipping a page. Memories. She began to read. I remember being 8 and hiding under the dining table while my mother screamed into a phone. I remember the way her voice would climb the walls like ivy, invasive, impossible to pull down. I remember thinking, she's always more interesting when she's angry. That scared me, because I wanted her to be interesting, even if it meant bleeding for it. My mouth went dry. She kept reading. I remember someone I loved telling me they were proud of me, and all I could think was, what did I do wrong? Because praise never came unless it followed injury. I remember learning to read faces faster than books. I remember telling myself that if I knew what everyone felt before they said it, maybe they wouldn't hurt me. She closed the notebook. Silence. That heavy kind. I swallowed. Thank you for sharing that. You don't need to thank me, she said. It's just data. It's more than data. That was intimate. I'm not sure I know the difference anymore. My chest tightened, but I kept my face neutral. That's not uncommon, I said carefully. Especially for people who were conditioned to serve other people's needs before their own, she interrupted. I nodded. Yes. She tilted her head. Were you? A beat passed. Too long. You're not here to ask about me, I reminded her. I know, but it's hard not to wonder. She leaned back on the couch, arms stretched across the top like a queen observing her court. It's funny, she said. I came here because I thought I needed help, but I think I just needed a mirror. And what are you seeing? I asked. She didn't answer right away. Finally, she said, someone who's lying, very beautifully. It was the first time in 3 sessions I physically recoiled. Not outwardly, not visibly, but something inside me jerked, a primal reaction. Her words weren't accusatory. They weren't even cruel. They were clinical, detached, as though diagnosing me was a natural step in our process. I adjusted the collar of my blouse, an unconscious stalling technique. What makes you think I'm lying? I asked softly. She shrugged. Does it matter? Lying isn't always bad. Sometimes it's protective. Sometimes it's necessary. And sometimes, it's the only way someone knows how to survive. Do you feel that way about yourself? Sometimes, she said. But I'm not talking about me. After she left that day, I locked the door behind her and slumped into the chair she'd just been sitting in. It was still warm. I stared at the bookshelf across from me, eyes unfocused, mind unraveling. Something had shifted. She wasn't just playing anymore. She was controlling, guiding the conversation with surgical precision, turning each session into a study not of herself, but of me. And the worst part, I was letting her. I didn't go home that night. Instead, I took a detour. A familiar street. A familiar door. A key I still kept on a chain around my neck, hidden beneath my blouse. The apartment I hadn't set foot in for almost a year. Not since the day I burned the bridge that carried me into this new identity. Inside, the air was stale. Dust clung to every surface like a memory refusing to let go. The furniture was covered with white sheets like corpses dressed for mourning. I peeled one back. The couch beneath was brown leather, cracked and worn at the edges. The place where I used to sit with him. My mentor. My mistake. The man who taught me everything about therapy and everything about manipulation. Dr. Malcolm Reed. He was brilliant, charismatic, magnetic, manipulative, and he ruined lives with a smile. Mine was just the last. He didn't know I found the journals, the tapes, the letters from former patients, his victims. He didn't know I spent months gathering evidence, documenting everything. He didn't know the fury he'd buried inside me would one day surface in the most calculated revenge. Ava Monroe was one of those patients. At least, I thought she was. But now I wasn't so sure. The next session came faster than I wanted. Thursday, 3 p.m. Again. She arrived 5 minutes early, but waited outside the door until I opened it. Power play. She wanted me to know she was capable of restraint, that she chose to wait, not because she had to, but because she wanted to unsettle me. It worked. Anything different today? I asked after we both settled. She smiled. I wore perfume. Fig and amber. I thought it might make the room feel softer. I didn't smell anything. She knew that. She leaned forward slightly. I had a dream. Would you like to share it? I was underwater, she said, her voice calm, too calm. But I could breathe. And there was someone next to me. A man. I couldn't see his face, but he was holding my ankle, keeping me from swimming to the surface. I scribbled on the pad, though I wasn't really writing. She continued. He wasn't trying to drown me. Just keep me with him. Did you feel afraid? No. That's the weird part. I felt guilty. Why? Because I wanted to leave him down there. I wanted to break his grip and float away. But I knew if I did, he'd disappear. And that matters to you? Yes, she said, her eyes gleaming. Because he knew the truth about me. I inhaled deeply, pressing my pen harder against the page to stop my hand from shaking. She was talking about Reed. I knew she was. But again, she never said his name. Just the shadow of him. Like a ghost wrapped in velvet. That night, I poured myself a glass of wine and sat by the window of my apartment, watching the rain streak down the glass like something trying to escape. I replayed her voice over and over in my head. He knew the truth about me. What did that mean? Did she know what I did? Did she think I was one of Reed's accomplices? Or worse, one of his disciples? And for the first time since this entire con began, I felt something I hadn't felt in years. Shame. Not because I was lying. Not because I was pretending to be someone I wasn't. But because deep down, a part of me still wasn't sure if I was capable of healing anyone, including myself. The boundary between therapist and patient had always been sacred to me, even if I'd crossed it for revenge. But now, sitting in the dark, I realized the line was gone. Ava wasn't just a mark anymore. She was becoming something else. A mirror. A threat. A story I no longer controlled. And maybe, just maybe, the dream wasn't hers at all. Maybe it was mine. Chapter 4. The breakthrough that broke me. There are moments in therapy that are supposed to feel sacred. Moments when a patient cracks open, bleeds just enough truth to stain the carpet, and trusts you to mop it up without judgment. They call it a breakthrough, like something divine, something earned. It's a lie, of course. Most breakthroughs aren't born from healing. They're born from exhaustion, from desperation, from a silent scream that finally claws its way out. I know this because I've studied them, not just in textbooks, but in people. Real people. Ones I pretended to help. Ones I watched come apart like threadbare sweaters unraveling in my hands. But today it was my turn to break. And she made sure it happened on camera. It started with the scarf. Ava entered the room 10 minutes late, which was already unusual. She was never late. Not once. But that day, she walked in without apology, wrapped in a deep red scarf that matched her lipstick. She dropped her phone onto the side table like a dare, and didn't bother to sit. She just stood there looking at me, like she'd rehearsed this moment in her head 100 times. I want to record today's session, she said flatly. I blinked. Why? I record myself sometimes, she replied. It helps me process after. I don't always remember what I say in the room. You understand the confidentiality agreement doesn't allow you to record, even if I'm the one providing services. Then let's do it with consent, she said. Let's put it on record. Together. I paused, pulse drumming beneath my ribs. A trap. It felt like a trap, but I couldn't say no. Not without raising suspicion. Not without confirming whatever it was she already suspected about me. So I nodded. All right. Just this once. I reached for the office's secure recording software. The same encrypted app one used to log client sessions under the real Dr. Lawrence's name. I clicked record. The light blinked red. And that was the moment everything shifted. I want to talk about the reason I'm here, Ava said, lowering herself into the couch like a queen onto a throne. Her posture was calm. Too calm. As if she knew the outcome of the conversation before it began. I kept my voice neutral. I thought we were already doing that. No, she said, we've been circling. But I want to say it out loud today. I folded my hands, pretending they weren't shaking. I was in love once, she said, with someone older. Powerful. He used to say I was the most intuitive person he'd ever met. That I saw through people like glass. I didn't speak. I thought he meant it as a compliment. But really, he meant it as a threat. Did he hurt you? She smiled faintly. Only every day. I shifted in my seat. What kind of hurt? The kind you can't report, she said. The kind no one takes seriously because there are no bruises. Just erosion. Little pieces of yourself chipped away until you don't remember who you were before they touched you. She stared at me, eyes unwavering. You ever been touched like that? There it was again. The sideways door. The not quite a question designed to bait me. I should have redirected. Should have asked what she meant. Should have handed her back the clinical flashlight and reminded her I was just the mirror. But I didn't. I said, yes. Her expression didn't change, but her body shifted. Leaned in. You don't talk about yourself much, she said. Why is that? Because this is your time. And what if I don't want it to be? I froze. She continued. What if I want to know who's listening to me? What if I need to understand why you seem to know what I'm thinking before I say it? That's empathy, I said too quickly. No, she said. That's familiarity. You don't feel what I feel. You felt it yourself. My mouth opened. Nothing came out. She was too close. Too accurate. And I was starting to slip. The rest of the session was a blur. She spoke in long, looping monologues, but they weren't really about her anymore. They were about me. About power. About observation. About the way predators learn to mimic their prey to get close. At one point she said, "You're either the best therapist I've ever had or the most dangerous." And I didn't correct her. Because in that moment, I didn't know which was true. After she left, I didn't stop the recording. I just sat there, staring at the screen, watching the red light blink. I could still smell her perfume, sweet and smoky, like embers after a storm. The scarf she wore had left a faint indentation on the couch cushion. Like evidence. Like an imprint. I stood up, pacing the room like an inmate, hands shaking. This wasn't therapy anymore. This was chess. And she had just moved her queen straight across the board. That night, I opened the file I'd kept hidden on my hard drive. Read Malcolm, private case log. I hadn't looked at it in over a year. Not since the day I decided to burn everything down. But tonight I needed answers. I needed to see her. I searched the log by initials first. AM. Nothing. Then I searched by keywords. Writer. Suicidal ideation. Female patient. Age under 25. Finally, I found a file. Patient number 19. Code name Ether. Ava. It had to be. But something didn't add up. The notes described her as unstable. Volatile. Resistant to treatment. Malcolm wrote about her with disdain. Not fear. Not guilt. But contempt. He called her a failed subject. Said she lacked utility. Utility? What the hell did that mean? I scrolled down. And that's when I saw it. Recommended for early termination. Termination. It wasn't a clinical term. It wasn't ethical. It was corporate. Cold. Strategic. And it chilled me to my core. Because it meant Ava wasn't just a victim. She was a survivor of something bigger than I'd ever realized. Something darker. Something I might have been complicit in, if only by association. I closed the file, heart racing, skin cold. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sit. I couldn't be. So I did something reckless. I pulled out the phone Malcolm had left behind when he fled. The burner I swore I'd destroy but never did. I powered it on. Scrolled through old texts. Scanned for her name. There. A single message. Patient Ether knows more than she says. Watch her. And beneath it. If she comes back, run. It all made sense now. Ava hadn't come to therapy. She'd come to hunt. Chapter 5. The guilt that wears my face. There's a kind of madness that doesn't look like screaming. It looks like control. It looks like remembering to water the plant. Reheating your coffee 3 times before drinking it. Straightening the diplomas on the wall, even though they aren't yours. It's the quiet, invisible kind. The kind that festers inside the walls of your mind, behind the curated bookshelves and the expensive couch cushions. The kind I had spent a year perfecting. And now it was unraveling at the seams. Because Ava Monroe wasn't my patient anymore. She was my puppeteer. It started before the session even began. A blank envelope, no return address, was slipped under the office door sometime before dawn. I found it that morning, neatly tucked beside the mail slot, as if whoever delivered it knew exactly what I'd be looking for. Inside, one photograph. Black and white. Slightly grainy. But unmistakable. Ava, 15 years old, sitting in a sterile waiting room with her hands folded tightly in her lap. Dressed in a school uniform. Eyes swollen. Cheek bruised. Next to her, Malcolm Reed. His hand resting gently on her shoulder. I dropped the photo like it burned. My hands trembled as I picked it up again, flipping it over. On the back, written in red ink, Do you still think this was about you? My stomach churned. I pressed my knuckles into my mouth to stop the sound that wanted to come out. Rage. Or grief. Or guilt. I couldn't tell which anymore. They all lived in the same room now. Because for the first time since assuming this identity, I realized I hadn't been watching Ava. She had been watching me. And the part that scared me the most, she was better at it. By the time 3 o'clock rolled around, my body was already in revolt. My hands were cold. My spine felt like it had been dipped in static. I kept the lights lower than usual, hoping the shadows would comfort me. Hide me. Shield me from whatever performance she had planned. But the moment she stepped into the room, I knew. She'd brought the stage with her. She wore a black dress. Not casual. Not comfortable. Something deliberate. Statement-making. The kind of thing you'd wear to a funeral or a court date. She didn't greet me. Didn't smile. Didn't sit. Instead, she walked over to the bookshelf and began running her fingers along the spines of the clinical volumes I never actually read. "Ever read this one?" she asked, pulling out The Body Keeps the Score. I nodded. "Yes." She flipped it open. "Trauma gets stored in the tissue. In the memory. In the silence." Then she looked at me and smiled. "Funny, isn't it? The way the body remembers what the mind tries to erase." I didn't answer. She didn't expect me to. She finally sat, legs crossed, the book still in her lap. "I think I'm ready to tell you the truth now," she said. I nodded slowly. "Okay. But first," she added, reaching into her bag, "you have to listen to something." She pulled out a small audio recorder and placed it between us like an offering. She pressed play, and I heard my own voice. Not hers. Not Malcolm's. Mine. From a night I thought I was alone. From a conversation I never recorded. "I didn't mean for it to go this far," my voice said. "I just wanted her to feel what I felt. I thought maybe she deserved it." I stopped breathing. The recording kept playing. Words I didn't remember saying, or maybe didn't want to. "She's not innocent. She let it happen. She watched and did nothing. You can't survive something like that without becoming complicit." Then static. And silence. The real kind. The crushing kind. I stared at the recorder, trying to make sense of how she'd captured that. When? Where? My apartment? The office? Had she bugged the couch? The bookshelf? "I wanted you to hear that," Ava said softly. "Because it means you still believe the lie." "What lie?" I whispered. "That this is about revenge," she said. "That I'm the one who broke you." I looked up at her, heart pounding. She was calm. Unshakable. "You were already broken when I found you," she continued. "I just gave you a mirror." "No," I said. "You orchestrated this. You manipulated me." She nodded. "Of course I did. You would have never listened otherwise." I stood too fast. My chair scraped violently against the hardwood. "You don't get to twist this," I snapped. "I've been helping you." She tilted her head. "Have you? Or have you just been reliving your own guilt through me?" I opened my mouth to argue, but there was nothing. Because she wasn't wrong. She stood too. Slowly. Deliberately. Walked toward the window, pulling back the curtain. "I remember this view," she said. "From when she used to sit here." It took me a second to realize who she meant. Dr. Lawrence. The real one. Before I took her name. Her office. Her life. Ava turned to me, eyes brighter than I'd ever seen them. "She knew about Reed," she said. "She tried to help. But she was sloppy." I swallowed. "What are you saying?" "She's not dead," Ava said. "But she's not coming back either." I stared at her. She stared back. And for the first time since this began, I realized we were both imposters in this room. Both wearing borrowed faces. Both trying to outlast the version of ourselves we couldn't escape. After she left, I didn't move for a long time. Just stood there, in the middle of the office, listening to the echo of her voice repeating inside my skull. "You were already broken when I found you." The words haunted me, not because they were cruel, but because they felt so accurate. I walked to the mirror above the fireplace and looked at myself. The reflection didn't blink, didn't breathe, just stared back with those same hungry eyes I remembered from years ago. Before I ever became Dr. Lawrence, before I learned to weaponize empathy, before I understood how easy it was to justify your own darkness when you convinced yourself it was righteous. I thought I'd stepped into this role to expose her. But maybe I just needed someone to witness me. To see the blood on my hands and say, "You're still worthy." And Ava? She saw it. She saw all of it. And she didn't flinch. She just waited. For me to crumble. For me to admit it. That I didn't just steal an identity. I stole hers. That night, I dreamed I was in a courtroom. Ava was the judge. Dr. Lawrence was the jury. And Malcolm sat beside me, smiling like the devil. When I tried to speak, my mouth filled with sand. I looked down. My hands weren't mine. They were Ava's, holding a tape recorder. Chapter 6, The Anatomy of Exposure. Some lies rot quietly. They curl into the corners of your life like mold behind wallpaper, unnoticed until the whole wall caves in. But others detonate, and mine was ticking. By the sixth session, I knew Ava wasn't just circling. She was closing in. I felt it in the way she walked into the room. No longer cautious, no longer performative. She didn't sit like a patient anymore. She claimed space. She didn't wait for questions. She asked them. She didn't fear the silence. She used it. And I was slipping further and further out of character, struggling to remember where the lie ended and I began. The day began with a simple message. A text. Unmarked number. Two words. Session moved. No explanation. No signature. Just the new time and an address. It wasn't the office. It was her apartment. I should have said no. Should have cited policy, ethics, safety. But policy didn't apply to me, and ethics had long since left the building. And maybe a part of me, maybe the worst part, wanted to go. Not because I thought I could fix this, but because I was tired of pretending I wasn't already buried in her hands. I got there at exactly 3 p.m. Not a second early. Not a second late. The building was old pre-war, with ivy strangling the outside and cracked steps that sighed beneath my heels. Her door was already open. She was waiting inside, barefoot, dressed in gray. The lights were low. The room smelled faintly of bergamot and something metallic. She gestured toward the couch without speaking. I sat down. There were no notebooks this time. No props. No barriers. Just her. Me. And a single camera tripod standing silently in the corner of the room, the lens already blinking red. "Thank you for coming," she said softly. My mouth was dry. "Why here?" "I wanted to remove distractions," she said. "The office, it's too safe." "You feel unsafe there?" "No," she said, sitting across from me. "You do." I looked at her for a long moment. She didn't blink. "I wanted to do something different today," she said, folding her hands. "I wanted to interview you." I opened my mouth to argue, but she cut me off with a smile. "I won't ask anything invasive. Just curious. Clients don't interview therapists," I said, trying to maintain some form of order of hierarchy. "But you're not a therapist, are you?" The words dropped like lead. I froze. She didn't smile this time. Just waited. "I never said." "You didn't have to," she said gently. "It's all in the silences. The cracks. The places where your story doesn't line up. I saw them early on. I just didn't care. Not at first. Why now?" She leaned forward, resting her chin on her hand. "Because I realized something. You're not here to help me. You're here because you need me to help you." "I'm here," I said slowly, "because I thought you deserved the truth." "Then tell me," she said, voice calm. "Right now. On record. Tell me the truth." My heart pounded. The camera blinked in the corner. Red. Steady. Patient. "I didn't kill anyone," I said. "It came out faster than I intended. I never hurt her." Ava raised an eyebrow. "Dr. Lawrence? She's alive. She just left. She left everything. Her license, her practice. I found it."
"I."
"You took it."
"Yes,"
I admitted.
"I took it.
I stepped in. But I only ever intended to expose him."
"Malcolm."
"And me," she asked. "What was your intention with me?" I stared at her. She stared back. "I thought you were still broken," I said quietly. "And I thought I could finish what she started. I thought if I could reach you, I could, maybe, undo what he did." I nodded. She sighed, standing slowly. "You really believed that, didn't you?"
"I still do."
She walked to the window, pulled the curtain slightly aside, then let it fall. "Tell me what you did," she said.
"All of it."
"I followed you," I confessed. "I waited for your name to show up in the clinic database. I kept your file open. I knew when you'd schedule. I cleared the time. I made sure I'd be the one to see you. I studied your case file. The one Malcolm kept. I knew. I knew he called you Ether." She turned. "And you still thought I wouldn't know who you were?"
"I didn't know you remembered me," I whispered.
"I didn't," she said. "Not right away. But I remembered your voice. That stopped me cold."
"We met once," she said, returning to the chair.
"You were in his office.
Younger.
Quiet. I thought you were one of the assistants. You told me to wait in the hallway." My throat tightened. "You had this coldness," she said.
but not because you didn't care, because you were trying not to. I didn't know what he was doing, I said, tears prickling now. Not until later. But you suspected. I didn't answer. You knew something wasn't right, she pressed. And you stayed. Silence. That horrible silence. I nodded. I stayed. She didn't yell. Didn't accuse. Just sat there. And that was worse. I don't hate you, she said after a long pause. I want you to know that. You should, I said. She tilted her head. Why? Because I played with your life. I manipulated you. I wore a stolen name. I used your pain as a ladder to climb out of mine. She nodded slowly. Yes, you did. I looked away. She continued. But here's the thing. I saw what you were doing, and I let you. Why? Because I needed something from you too, she said. Closure. Clarity. Someone who'd look me in the face and see me. Not as a victim. Not as a case study. But as someone who made it through hell and came out still breathing. I couldn't hold it back anymore. Tears slid down my face. The kind I never let fall. Not even when I stole my first identity. Not even when I buried my own name. I don't know who I am anymore, I admitted. That's okay, Ava whispered. Neither do I. The camera kept recording. The light never stopped blinking. And for the first time, it didn't matter. Because we were both exposed now. Two women unmasked. Unmade. And maybe that was the only kind of truth that ever really mattered. Chapter 7. Confession is a kind of resurrection. When I was a child, I thought confession was the final step. The purge. The great exhale. The moment the weight lifts and the slate wipes clean. But I was wrong. Confession isn't the end. It's the beginning of consequences. And once the words are out, once you stop pretending, stop performing, stop hiding beneath someone else's credentials and someone else's name, the world doesn't offer absolution. It offers exposure. And exposure is a different kind of death. The video was uploaded 2 days after that final session. I didn't know she'd recorded the whole thing. Not just the part she showed me, not just the curated performance she placed on the table like bait. No, she had the entire series. 6 sessions. 2 locations. Hours of footage. All of it. Every lie. Every flicker of guilt I'd tried to swallow. It hit the internet like blood in the water. I found out through a voicemail. From the real Dr. Lawrence. Yes, her. The woman I stole everything from. Her voice was hoarse, raw, like she hadn't spoken in weeks. You've made quite the mess, she said. But I suppose we both did. She didn't threaten me. She didn't scream. She didn't ask for her life back. She just sounded tired. I hope, she added, you were at least honest with her in the end. I wasn't. Not fully. Because there's always more to the story than anyone ever gets to know. The fallout came fast. By noon that day, the clinic door had been spray-painted with the word fraud. My online alias was dismantled in under an hour. Licensure boards issued official statements. Therapy forums exploded. Reddit did what Reddit does. And the video? It wasn't just trending. It was studied. Every pause. Every breath. Clipped. Reposted. Translated. Turned into think pieces and TED Talks and trauma podcasts. Some people called it performance art. Others called it evidence. Some said I was a monster. Others a martyr. And Ava? She disappeared. Just like that. No interviews. No press. Not even a cryptic Instagram post. She simply vanished. And left me with the pieces. I stayed hidden for 6 days. No windows. No mirrors. No phone. Just me and the silence. And guilt. Guilt is a tricky thing. It doesn't just haunt. It shapes. It distorts your reflection until you're not sure whether you're a villain, a victim, or just another version of what hurt you. On the 7th day, I walked into a police station. Not to confess. Not exactly. I didn't kill anyone. I didn't assault anyone. I didn't forge prescriptions or steal medication. I hadn't even charged for therapy services. Technically, legally, I'd walked the razor's edge. But I was still a fraud. A manipulator. A woman who sat in front of wounded people and mirrored their pain for my own selfish gain. And that felt like a kind of violence. The officer looked at me like I was wasting his time. He asked for ID. I gave him 3 different ones. None of them mine. I asked him, what happens when you steal a life but nobody reports it missing? He blinked. Is this a riddle? No, I said. It's a confession. They released me within hours. No charges filed. Just a warning. A stern lecture. A reference number in a database. It wasn't satisfying. It wasn't punishment. It was worse. It was permission to keep going. So I did the only thing left to do. I created a video of my own. No lighting, no script, just me, sitting in a bare apartment with hollow eyes and trembling hands. And this is what I said. My name doesn't matter. I pretended to be a therapist. I wore someone else's name and sat in someone else's chair and offered someone else's comfort. But every word I spoke was mine, and every tear she cried, I carried, and every truth she forced out of me, I owe her for. I didn't help her. She helped me see the rot inside my reflection. I ended the video there. No apology. No explanation. Because some things aren't meant to be forgiven. Weeks passed. The buzz died down. The world moved on like it always does. Some new scandal replaced mine. Some celebrity overdosed. Some tech company collapsed. The algorithm forgot me. But I didn't forget her. Not Ava. Not what she did. Not what she knew. And not what she chose. Because that's the part that lingers. Not the exposure. Not the unraveling. But the choice. She chose not to destroy me completely. She could have. She had the footage. The evidence. The receipts. But she released just enough to shatter the illusion, not the person. She let me keep my face. So I did the only thing I could with it. I started over. I work in a shelter now. No credentials. No clipboard. Just a body. A pair of ears. A voice. I mop floors. I hand out blankets. I hold hands when the air outside is too cold for language. I listen, but I don't offer solutions. I've learned that the deepest kindness is sometimes just presence. Unlabeled. Unlicensed. Unremarkable. Sometimes people ask me if I used to be a therapist. I say no, because I never was. I was just a mirror. And now I am glass shattered in just the right way. Sometimes late at night, I still hear her voice. Not in memory, in echo. Like she's still speaking through me. Ava Monroe. The girl they thought was broken. The girl who walked into a room with a predator's scent still on her skin and sat across from a woman wearing a stolen name. And gave her a truth so sharp, it carved her free. Not just from Malcolm, but from me. This isn't a happy ending, but it is an honest one. And after everything I stole, it's the only thing I have left to give.